Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best of public radio, brought to you by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm your host, Scott Carrier. This week, we go to war, getting in and getting out. I have two stories, one about the days leading up to the beginning of the war in Afghanistan in 2001, the other about the fall of Saigon in 1975. Like most people in the world, I watched the events of September 11th unfold on television. I watched the television, and then I looked outside my window, and I looked back at the television, and then back outside my window. My world, the physical things around me, looked the same, but the narrative that held it all together had been ripped in half. I called Ira Glass at This American Life and told him I wanted to drive around the country interviewing people about how they felt. Not pundits or experts, but common men and women I met at random. And he said, "Why don't you drive from Salt Lake to Chicago and ask people if they're ready to go to war?" So I started driving north towards Yellowstone because it was fall and the leaves would be changing and I wanted to drive through the countryside, not through the cities. My first stop was in Afton, Wyoming, a small town. It was getting dark and I saw lights from a playing field, so I stopped to watch a soccer game and talk to people in the bleachers.
Okay, I'm Shane Hoganson. We're in Star Valley, Wyoming. It's kind of a small rural area. Most of the economy is based on dairy farming and whatnot.
How old are you?
I'm 18.
So the question I'm asking everybody is, are you ready to go to war?
I think it's scary, and I'm draftable, so if it does turn into something that's major or something, then, you know, I could be shipped off to someplace I don't want to go and doing something I don't really want to do.
So are you ready to go to war? No, you're not.
If my country needs me, I'll go. I think it's my responsibility as American that if my country needs me, I'll go and I'll die for my country, but I'll be proud of it. But I'm not sure if I support the exact cause of why we'd be fighting this war. I mean, I think the perpetrator should be punished, but I'm not sure if going to war is going to solve that, especially when you don't have any specific real enemy to be going after.
My name is Jenny Hansen, and we're in Afton, Wyoming, at my 15-year-old soccer game. Am I ready to go to war? You know, I believe that if it's going to make the world a safer place to live, if you can eliminate terrorism, yeah, I would support it. Yeah, I mean, I have 5 sons, and yeah, it's scary to even think about going to war, but that's the price of freedom.
Even if it meant your own sons going to war?
Yeah, even if it meant my own sons. That's, you know, that's scary, but all the other mothers would have to sacrifice their sons too, and there will be those that will run, but that's their choice. But to me, the price of freedom is through sacrifice.
I drove through one of the southern entrances to Yellowstone Park at midnight and pulled off the road on some kind of dirt loop and slept, waking up in the early morning looking straight at Mount Moran, the Teton with a white tongue of snow, a couloir down the center of the eastern face. I followed the Yellowstone River to Mammoth Hot Springs, out of the park, and down Paradise Valley to Deep Creek, where I stopped to talk to Doug Peacock.
Yeah, my name is Doug Peacock, and we're sitting in my front yard, which is an old farmhouse with a huge cottonwood tree that's dying, and we're in the shade of the cottonwood right now. If I learned anything from Vietnam, it's just that there was no enlightenment in homicide. And what finally sent me over the edge was the Tet Offensive, where my little A camp, I was a Green Beret medic, and my little A camp, the Viet Cong drove a couple hundred civilians across the river, and our A camp called in gunships on them, and about 180 women and children were killed and wounded. And I was the only medic there, and I spent my last 2 weeks in Vietnam splicing the back together bodies, and that pushed me over the edge. And I just realized that either I was going to have to live the rest of my life with an eye for an eye notion, or to retain any trace of humanity, I was going to have to really suffer with this You know, the enemy is within, and it's in all of us. And I think the greatest thing we could do, having been the victim, finally we've been the victim, is to realize that our own hands are not that clean at all. I think the most courageous thing we could do is not strike back at all, not strike back. No eye for an eye, you know, defeat hate, and you can't do that by war and violence. You got to do it by, you know, by love. And you get there, I think, by looking at the sufferings of others, even the ones we don't like out there.
I remembered reading in Black Elk Speaks, or maybe Great Plains by Ian Fraser, that Crazy Horse, when he was killed, was trying to get back to the Powder River on the northwest side of the Black Hills. But he was stabbed, held by a friend and bayoneted in the back at Fort Robinson, way on the other side of the mountains. I asked Peacock how to get to the Powder River, and he got out a map and showed me. He said, on your way, go through Plenicoo and stop at the museum. I found the museum, 150 miles to the east, 40 miles down a dirt road, and when I walked in, the woman at the desk said, are you lost? Her name was Bernadette Smith.
Are you ready to go to war?
No, I'm not ready to go to war, but we have to protect our citizens, so if war is inevitable, then I will support it.
Do you have any young relatives that would might be going?
I have a... Oh, I shouldn't tell you this.
Oh, that's all right. You don't have to.
My nephew's in the Marine Reserves, and he's in Bulgaria now.
Oh.
He's in the reconnaissance battalion. And then he called... He said the next time we heard from him would probably be through his staff sergeant.
She's kind of hard to understand because she's crying, but she's saying that her nephew, whom she raised as a son, called and said goodbye. That the next call she'd get would be from a staff sergeant saying he'd been killed.
He's a paratrooper in the... Probably the first to go in when you go in searching for somebody and pride themselves on.
I mean, how do you feel about that?
I personally don't like it, but, you know, kids are raised, they have their dreams, they want to be macho, they want to save their country. He's a Crow Indian and he wants to help save the tribe, promote peace, so I, you know. What can you do but support him? That's not what you raised him for, but that's if that's one of their goals, you just have to accept it.
The battlefield of the Little Bighorn is 60 miles east of the Plenicoo Museum, still in Montana. It looks just like it does in the movies, a pathetic knob on a grass prairie, a lonely place to be slaughtered. There are crosses marking where Custer and his brother fell, along with all of his men, more than 260, mostly immigrants. They ran out of bullets and were scalped.
My name is Bill Bennett, and we're traveling through Custer National Park right now. There's a national cemetery here. The cemetery houses veterans of clear back to Spanish-American War, clear up to the Korean War. Let's pray and hope that we don't have any from the Taliban War that may eventually be buried here. I lived in Iran for 2.5 years when the Afghan coup in 1978 came.
Why were you over there in Iran at that
time? I was a maintenance advisor to the Iranian Air Force when they were attempting to get their Air Force up to a comparable Air Force with the United States government on their F-16s and F-4s and some of those things back in late 70s. And I've driven across Afghanistan, so I got a pretty good feel for the country and the mountains, and I think for them to put troops on the grounds in there with that type of terrain and everything is going to be disastrous. The terrain is in the northern part there is very, very mountainous, and in the desert it's just high brush. And to give you an example, we were driving a Chevrolet Blazer across there, and another couple was with us. we'd drive across the flat plain and just nothing but brush and sand as far as the eye could see. We'd stop and pull off the road and put the back door of the Blazer down and get some drinks and some sandwiches or something out, and in 10 minutes there'd be two or three men standing around us. And they had these sandy-colored leather coverings on, and you couldn't see them. You'd never, ever see them out in the desert. And they were curious enough that when we stopped, they'd come up and they wouldn't take any water, they wouldn't take anything. How they lived out there, I don't have any idea, but as proven by the Russians being in there, that's why they whipped the Russians, because you just don't see them.
So if you were called, I realize you're past that age, but if you were of age and you were called now, would you go?
Of course I would. You betcha. Every time they play the national anthem, I get a tear in my eye. So I'm as true an American as you'll ever find.
Pine Ridge Reservation for the Ogallala Lakota is on the high plains on the eastern side of the Black Hills, South Dakota. Wounded Knee is there, the site of the 1890 massacre of 300 men, women, and children wiped out for ghost dancing. The town of Pine Ridge has a distinct third world feel to it. One taco stand, a gas station run out of a mobile home, a grocery store with sale prices painted on butcher paper and stapled to the walls outside, some coming apart in the wind and blowing around the parking lot. I was standing next to my truck in the parking lot, drinking a Pepsi, and there were two men in a beat-up Monte Carlo next to me. The one in the passenger seat called over, "Hey, hey, my friend wants to see your badge." Somehow I got him to agree to an interview.
Hello, my name is George Restar. I'm 37 years old. I am from Wounded Knee, South Dakota.
Okay, so the question I've been asking everybody is, are you ready to go to war?
Of course. Oglala Lakotas are always warriors, aren't they? We will, they done. It's going to happen. And no fear, you know. We will do it.
Would you personally sign up?
No, I've been to Panama, Gulf. No, I will though, again.
You're a veteran?
Yeah.
So what do you think about the war on terrorism? Think it's, how do you feel about it?
Did you see it's a senseless cause. An enemy you can reach and touch and kill, but this one, faceless, no?
Why would you be so, why are you so willing to support it if it's a war like that?
Because of the flag. My dad served in World War I, World War II, and patriotism, no? That's what it is.
But, okay, but you're willing to go because of the warrior tradition.
Yeah, of course.
It's really
the idea
of fighting. And
it's an adrenaline flow of reaching inside another person's body and pulling that heart out while it's still beating. That's the way it is.
Driving across South Dakota, I can't remember it. The Missouri was dammed into a reservoir. I do remember that. Maybe I drove most of it at night. I know I woke up in southern Minnesota, found a town, and stopped at a restaurant that opened early.
Chuck Murphy from Blue Earth, Minnesota. We're in a restaurant called Hamilton's.
We meet down here on Sunday morning. We call it our Sunday school, but we still all go to church yet. But it's just something we do. We get together.
Okay, so the question I've been asking everybody is, are you ready to go to war?
Oh, I think we should go to war.
How about you, sir?
Well, I don't know. It's about, I think it is really going to be good for this country. It's going to bring everybody together. It is. Because I think what had happened before is we started going, in our own separate directions. people were doing this and doing that, and this has just plain brought the country back together again, and I think it's going to be a whole different country from now on.
Driving around, listening to talk radio, it didn't seem to me like the country was becoming more united.
Frankly, I'm shocked at what I'm hearing from you. I can't believe that you're so un-American, and you're attacking... Oh, free speech, my foot. You know what? You know what? I'm starting to get livid at your attacks on the United States of America and this president.
I'm not attacking this country.
You have been.
I don't know why you had me on.
I don't either. You're right. That's the first smart thing you've said. Get her off the phone. Goodbye. 1-800-655-MIKE. I don't know why I had her on either. You know, there's no room for that kind of voice right now in America. We don't need her. Go over to Afghanistan.
I'm Ryan Walden, and I'm a biologist here at Northeastern Iowa. And this is a Hawk Watch weekend, and I do educational programs with birds of prey.
Has your life changed since the Tuesday attack?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it has, and in a very strange way. One of the items that I talk about in the program, and I've done my program since 1970, is that the call of the barn owl sounds like a hysterically screaming woman. No one has ever commented on that before, and yet yesterday there were two complaints registered that I had said that.
Can you understand that? You think it's...
I think that it's absolutely, totally, and completely ridiculous. Will I change? Yes, simply because I am paid to be here, and my job is to educate people and not to offend them. But I think that the American people should stop whining about Mickey Mouse things such as that and get some handle on what is really important.
The wind had been blowing hard from the north, coming down from Canada, and it clouded up and started to rain. I crossed the Mississippi at Prairie du Chien, Prairie of Dog, Wisconsin, headed for Madison through farm country, rolling fields of corn, waves of corn, big silos and barns. I saw two Amish boys walking down the road, and I pulled into a driveway and waited for them to come up to me.
Come up here a little closer.
Do we have to do this now?
I mean, our religion is...
We just as well stay away from it if we can, but you gotta have our advice.
I don't have to have your advice. I'm asking you for it. Yeah. I could.
Well, we will consciously object to fighting with firearms. All we know is what the neighbors are saying. We have no electricity. We don't get it. Well, we get it. Weekly newspaper, but we do not know what is going on out there.
Huh. What have you heard?
Well, we've heard that the planes crashed in New York, and we've heard there were a lot of people lost. But we pray for you in our churches, but we are not involved in your... We are not involved in this.
Now I'm in Chicago, staying at the Hotel Intercontinental on the 25th floor. From my window I can look across and see the flying buttresses on top of the Tribune building, a building with stones mortared into its base from battlefields, monuments, and temples from around the world. One from the Great Wall of China, one from the Colosseum in Rome, stones from the islands of Corregidor and Guam, from Pearl Harbor, one from the Little Bighorn in Yellowstone Park, even a rock from Injun Joe's cave along the Mississippi River, and a section of a California redwood. It's late at night. There's one car on Grand Avenue all the way to Navy Pier, reaching out into Lake Michigan. A drunk crossing the street and stumbling at the curb, falling down on the sidewalk and getting up, staggering towards home. It's a beautiful night, the moon half full. I keep forgetting watching the buildings come down. But they did come down, and now we're going to war. More limbs blown off, guts exploded open, eyes gouged out, and heads chopped off. I remember listening to the beginning of the Bears-Viking game driving into town on Sunday. I realized that you shouldn't go into a fight thinking you might lose, or thinking you might win, or wondering whether what you're doing is right or wrong. The best advice is to not think at all.
I am ready. Oh, my children, when Jesus knocks at my door.
You're listening to a Hearing Voices Hour about getting in and out of war. That last story was originally broadcast on This American Life in the first week of October, 2001.
Don't weep for me, I'll be with my Lord.
This, of course, is Dolly Parton, a song called I Am Ready.
There's my Bible on the table. Read it to me. Can hear God's heavenly angels singing me on through heaven's door. Hallelujah, Lord, I am ready. No more sorrow. Hallelujah, yes, I am ready. I am ready. Ready to go, oh, oh, Hosanna. Take my hand now, lead me to the promised land now. I am ready, I am ready, hallelujah, I am ready to go.
To War, from Hearing Voices.
Ready.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Hearing Voices. This week we're off to war, getting in and getting out. We just heard people talking about going to war in Afghanistan. Now we have a story about pulling out of Vietnam. But first, this is the beginning of the film, Apocalypse Now.
Saigon. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm going to wake up back in the jungle. When I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and there'd be nothing. I hardly said a word to my wife until I said yes to a divorce. was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle.
I wanted to play that because the voice of Captain Willard in the movie reminds me of the voice of a real guy in this next story, a documentary about the evacuation of Saigon, originally broadcast on All Things Considered in 1985, 10 years after the end of the war. It's almost 26 minutes long, and a lot of people are interviewed, but the story is wrapped around a tape made by a helicopter pilot, and I think if you listen, you can hear the whole war in his voice. Noah Adams narrates.
10 years ago today, the last American was lifted by helicopter off the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, ending America's long and painful involvement in Vietnam. This story is about that last day and about the people who were able to get out then on American helicopters and those who were left behind. It's also the story of an American pilot who flew one of those helicopters. His name is Richard Van de Geer, Air Force Second Lieutenant Van de Geer. In May 1975, he sat down and talked into a tape recorder. He was making a cassette to send home to his best friend. He needed someone to talk to. He'd had a busy month. Before Vietnam, there had been Cambodia. Van de Geer and his helicopter had helped to evacuate people from the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh. It was an experience that left him drained. He went on military leave, rest and recreation in Bangkok, Thailand. He had just checked into a hotel room.
So the moment I walked into the room, I told him I wanted flowers in the room and I wanted some gin. But I wanted the best body massage that Bangkok had to offer. And a place and a woman for me. And keep in mind, I had been up about 40 hours, and I was still having flashbacks of Phnom Penh.
Those flashbacks of Phnom Penh, he wanted to burn them out of his mind. And maybe if he got enough sleep, drank enough gin, and had that body massage, maybe he could forget about it. But it was not to be. The front desk called with a message from headquarters.
The message said that there would be a plane waiting for me at the airport at 1700 to take me back. Of course, it was hard to believe that there could be such injustice in the world. But be assured there is. I really didn't have a good idea why I was being recalled. I had no clear idea as to what was going on. But we felt as though it had something to do with Saigon.
He was right. It was Saigon. A lot of people wanted to get out before the communists took over. Everyone had heard rumors. A bloodbath would follow. There would be acts of revenge for those who worked with the Americans. Some Vietnamese had already left. The American military airlifted them out of the country on cargo planes. But on that last day, the North Vietnamese destroyed the airport runway.
The ground and artillery attack on the Tham Sanut base came at 4 o'clock in the morning.
And all of a sudden, boom, boom, background explosions, and then the building started shattering.
At an airport gymnasium, State Department officer Joe McBride was at work processing refugees.
The phosphorescent bulbs in the ceiling were coming crashing down, and one, including one that came down and crashed on my head, and I said, oh, sh-.
Peter Arnett worked for the Associated Press. He had seen more of the war in Vietnam than most reporters.
We were all in the Caravelle Hotel, and there was this enormous shelling and explosions from the direction of the airport. I remember opening my window, and the night sky was lit up with explosives. I went to the roof of the Caravelle Hotel, and there were dozens of newsmen there.
And we could see black plumes of smoke coming up from Thon Sanut Airport.
You could see the muzzle flashes.
And in the next half hour, we saw three aircraft shot down by rockets.
What they were doing was the North Vietnamese were telling the Americans and the South Vietnamese that Thon Sanut was no longer a conduit out of the Republic of South Vietnam.
U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington was at the airport.
My reaction was that, well, this is it. We're going. And to me, the phrase, we're going, meant that we were going to leave the Republic of Vietnam by helicopter.
On the morning of April 29, 1975, Jack Cahill, a reporter for the Toronto Star, was in Saigon waiting for a prearranged signal to tell him the final evacuation had begun.
Well, we were supposed to be all waiting to hear White Christmas being played on the FM radio. That was the signal for the evacuation.
That was a part of the plan. We call it the plan, in quotes.
U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington.
The plan said that we were going to signal everyone when it was time to assemble at the safe sites. And the signal that the evacuation was on and that Americans should discreetly report to these safe sites was to be the playing of Bing Crosby's White Christmas, accompanied by the phrase that the temperature in Saigon is 105 and rising, or something like that.
And only the Americans were supposed to know that, you know?
American Julie Forsythe, she was a Quaker worker in Saigon.
Now you can imagine how long only the Americans knew that. Maybe 10 minutes. You know, we heard about it from other Vietnamese people. We didn't hear about it from the Americans.
Very early in the morning, a friend of mine, a doctor, a Vietnamese doctor, he came over to my home very early and he said, now we have to get out of Vietnam very quickly, otherwise we'll be trapped in.
Later on, like many other Vietnamese, she was frightened. She was forced into making agonizing decisions.
I try to select things, but we can bring only 20 kilos. How can we bring? My mother wanted to take the incense bowl in my father's altar. In our house, we have an altar to the ancestors. And I pray for my father. I say, we are leaving you. And I asked him to protect us in our crossing of the ocean, but I felt so guilty because I know that from that day on, we will no longer be Vietnamese, you see.
Many Vietnamese made the painful decision to give up their country that morning. On this last day of the war, helicopter pilot Van de Geer was on the aircraft carrier Midway, waiting with other American helicopter pilots for orders to begin the evacuation.
The Vietnamese Huey flew out towards sea and found the carrier. And the man who got out of this aircraft was quoted as saying approximately a week earlier that any South Vietnamese that left the country were cowards and that everybody should remain in South Vietnam and fight to the bitter end. This man was General Key. Now, I really don't have any personal feelings about, you know, the war over here. I really don't care one way or the other. But I did find myself feeling that I wish he had been shot down.
But Van de Geer soon had to put thoughts of the flamboyant Nguyen Cao Key out of his mind. The orders had finally come down. Van de Geer and the other helicopter pilots climbed into their aircraft and headed off toward Saigon, 40 minutes away by air. Late in the morning, Canadian reporter Jack Cahill was still doing his job covering the news. As he did, Vietnamese on motorbikes and on foot carrying suitcases made him sense it was time to go.
But it was all terribly confusing. Nobody ever heard White Christmas or anything being played, and nobody knew where to go or what to do. But anyway, I filed my story, walked back to the hotel, and everybody had gone.
In Saigon, TV cameraman Barry Fox was standing with other reporters next to an evacuation bus. The bus was lost and had been circling around the city for hours. It ended up at the Saigon riverfront.
And it was at that point that I suddenly realized that the air was full of helicopters. And I looked up, and there were just dozens of helicopters flying over the port. So we got back on the bus, and that, at that time, created amongst the now panicking Vietnamese who were at the port when we got there. They saw the bus leaving. They wanted to get on the bus. They were trying to climb in the windows of the bus, and people were hanging onto the outside, and the driver drove away. We slowed down to go out the gate, and a woman carrying a baby jumps on. The bus doesn't stop, and nobody's stopping. And we, you know, the general, there's an air of hysteria, and she loses her grip on her baby, and the baby falls off the bus, and then she jumps off the bus, and the bus, as far as I could gather, ran over the baby.
Fear made people do terrible things on that last day, But along with hysteria, there were acts of courage. State Department Officer Joe McBride saw a little of both. His job was to drive people from points around the city to evacuation pickup spots. McBride remembers it was almost impossible to organize an orderly departure because the evacuees were afraid of being left behind. However, McBride recalls one exception.
There was a big Vietnamese that had in civilian clothes, big tall Vietnamese, spoke good English, came up to me and as I was trying to organize things and said, maybe I can help you. And he said, what are your priorities? And I laid out my priorities as best I could. And he said, fine, I'll take care of it. I came back four or five times after that guy started organizing things. And he would generally have a group of people lined up and organized, and I'd take them. I turned to him and I say, look, I'm running out of gas. I'm running out of time. The choppers are leaving. This is going to be the last run. And I asked the guy, where's your family? And it's you and your family now. He said, we can't do it. I said, what do you mean? He says, I've got 24 people in my family. There's no way we can do it in just one run. And I said, they're telling me I've got to go home. And the guy just said, well, it's been nice working with you. Extended his hand, shook mine, and said, see you around. Thanks for trying.
I made 3 sorties into Saigon. No, 4 sorties, I'm sorry. I could tell you about how real the fear was that I felt. The VC had commandeered Air America Hueys, and they were flying them around, which simply made a very interesting chess game.
As the day wore on, it became clear that promises would have to be broken. Promises to Vietnamese who had worked for the Americans that they would get out on this final day. There were delays in the helicopter lifts. The plan was falling apart. The North Vietnamese were surrounding the city. A young Vietnamese woman, Chung Wan Lem, worked for the South Vietnamese government. An American friend was supposed to tell her when it was time to evacuate. She waited but didn't hear from him.
For me, that was the last blow. So I decided that I have to go to the embassy. So I tried to make my way to the Marine, and I asked one of the Marines, I said, could I go in the embassy? And the Marine said, there's no one in embassy now, except people who have been accepted to go there to wait for the helicopters. Do you have a pass? And I said, no, I don't. And so the Marine said, then in that case, I'm sorry.
People have brought their possessions and their bundles and whatever was important to them, and we're trying to carry them through the crowd.
I have my wife standing with my 2 children, and I try to get in to the gate, but they give us a warning that anyone try to break in, they're going to shoot to death.
I saw all the newsmen with their equipment and so on, and that also gave me a feel that, in fact, the situation was desperate. Otherwise, news people would not leave.
It was just solid Vietnamese, shoulder to shoulder, pushing, shouting.
I got to the side gate and I wanted to get over.
The State Department's Joe McBride, back at the embassy after picking up all the Vietnamese he could.
Obviously, they couldn't open that gate. And the Marine said, no, sir, I can't let you over. I said, why not? He says, if you do, they'll start coming and then I'll have to shoot. I don't want to have to shoot them, sir. Please don't come over.
I could see from what was going on around me that the embassy was getting worried as to how it was going to survive the onslaught of all these people. The absolute knowledge that there was no way the helicopters were going to get all these people out of the compound.
I circulated through the crowd, walking gently, pushing through, excuse me, don't worry, there's plenty of helicopters for everybody, all this in Vietnamese, of course. We're not going to abandon, don't worry. Just didn't want panic to start. And quietly gathered about 25 or 30 Americans who were out there with their dependents. And at that point, the 2 Marines came over the gate, and they must have been 6'2", 6'5". They were big, big men wearing the flak jackets and the helmets. The Marines kept pushing the crowd back. Every time we'd let somebody else through, particularly a Vietnamese with an American, people waving papers and, you know, testimonies, why they had to get out, stories. We're doing everything we can do to keep the panic down, and I'm assuring everybody constantly. And every once in a while, the Marines will lock and load their rifles, with the bolts to make a snapping sound, scare people back. And I'm thinking, God, these guys are cool. So all it would have taken is one panicked person with a grenade, one person going out of their mind with a knife.
Originally, the U.S. Embassy was not among the general evacuation points at all. It was to be reserved as the way out for the ambassador and his staff. However, by late afternoon, it had become an irresistible last hope for Vietnamese wanting to leave. More than 6,000 of them had gotten out by way of a safe corner of the city's Tan Sanut Airport and other spots. But with nightfall, the helicopters had stopped going to those places, but were still coming to the embassy compound. The 1,000 who had found their way inside the walls considered themselves lucky.
Repeatedly, we told these folks, if you'll all cooperate, we'll all go. But these choppers cannot take your suitcases. Please throw them all away. I mean, these people were good. They threw away everything. The only people we had problems with, ironically, were Americans. And the number of Americans in the crowd, before we got rid of them all, argued that, this is my right, or, I'll write my congressman, and groused about it. But the Vietnamese were good. They were docile and cooperative once we got them under control.
We thought that they were going to call off the operation when it became dark, because we never expected them to send us into such a bad situation to begin with, even if it was daytime. But as you probably know, they continued the mission on until nearly 5 o'clock in the morning. The night sorties were the worst, because we flew lights out. The tracers kept everybody on edge. To see a city burning gives one a strange feeling of insecurity.
At the embassy, Americans had been delaying their own departures as long as they could to keep the helicopters coming for the Vietnamese. But Washington was ordering them to get out. The CIA's Frank Snipp.
The halls were overrun with humanity because the evacuation was going off the roof at this point. There were helicopters going off the roof, and the embassy had become a labyrinth of humanity. People were hungry. They had animals tucked under their arms. They were screaming for water, and we pushed our way through them as we made our way up the stairwell towards the helicopter pad. I felt such shame because we were leaving before the Vietnamese in that embassy.
The State Department's Joe McBride.
I was ready to leave. I'd done what could be done. In any case, whoever was loading said, "We need a couple. Joe, how about you? You're ready." It was all red inside. The chopper was all red. It was like the night lights that they would use on a submarine or something. This is a very high-pitched whine that I'd never heard before. Incredible, like a turbine kind of whining sound. And the back gate was down enough that when the helicopter lifted off, and by the time it had lifted off and we were heading out over Saigon, it was dark. And you could see fires in the city. You could see fires in a lot of places.
It was now a little after 5 in the morning, Saigon time, April 30th, 1975. The helicopters were coming further apart, but a final 6 of them were due in. That would be enough to handle the remaining 420 Vietnamese citizens waiting in the embassy courtyard. Waiting with them were Captain Stuart Harrington, Colonel John Madison, and another Army officer. Captain Harrington describes what happened next.
The senior Marine on the scene was a Major Jim Keane. And Keane came out of the embassy, went up to Colonel Madison and said, "Sir, the evacuation's over. It's Americans only." And Colonel Madison looked at Keane. I was standing right there. And he said, "No way. We have these 420 people here, and We were promised that there'd be the 6 more lifts that we need, and we're not leaving until they're gone. And Keene said, can't do it. He said, it's a presidential order, and I'm not going to risk the safety of my men any longer, his men who were around the perimeter of the embassy. Madison said, I'll take it up with the ambassador. And Keene went, you can't, sir. He just left, and he pointed to a CH-46 that was leaving and just taken off, was about 50 feet in the air above the roof of the embassy. Good soldier that he was, Colonel Madison made that call. He said, okay, Stu, you stay here with the radio, with these people, and play like everything's normal, and we'll slip into the embassy and get up to the roof, and you make it up to the roof when you can. So I went to the trunk deck of a car that had its headlights on, pointed, and where the people were all, you know, I'm sitting here, the people were 5 feet away, the first row. And I sat there with this radio, talking to helicopters that weren't there, and the people kept saying, Dai Wei, Dai Wei, Kwa Truk Tang Hong, is the helicopter coming? And I would tell them, Don't go la, don't worry. Kwa Truk Tang Lun, Sap Tai, a big helicopter is coming, don't worry, don't worry. And I did that for 5 or 10 minutes until I thought I'd given them enough time. So I put the radio down and I said to the Vietnamese nearest to me, Mak Dai, which means I got to take a leak. And I slipped over into the bushes and then I made a quick move and into the door of the embassy and charged up the stairs.
Captain Harrington ran up to the embassy roof, climbed aboard a partially filled helicopter, and left. Now, after 16 years of fighting, the American presence in the Republic of South Vietnam was down to 11 Marines. There was a long wait for another helicopter. The Marines thought they had been forgotten. When it did come, they knew they had to make a run for it. The question was, could they get to the roof before the Vietnamese? Sergeant Terry Bennington.
Well, we backed in slowly initially, and then when they realized what we were doing, they started for us, and we headed for the door. And I think we beat them with maybe a second to spare. And we got the door shut and got it barred. And, of course, that wasn't going to hold them that long, and we knew that. So everybody got up onto the roof at that time. And then we barred the doors on the roof, and there were still, you know, it didn't take long for the Vietnamese to get through the door and come up that ladder well. So we took CS gas, and we took red smoke and green smoke and any other smoke we could get our hands on. And it did work. Once we threw the red smoke and the CS gas and everything, they started running. Unfortunately, the turbines of the engine started to suck the CS gas inside of the chopper, so we kind of gassed ourselves there, too. But the chopper pilot finally looked back, and I think he saw what was happening, and he got us out of there pretty quick. Definitely got us out of there pretty quick.
The evacuation has now been completed. The President commends the personnel of the armed forces who accomplished it, as well as Ambassador Graham Martin and the staff of his mission, who served so well under difficult conditions. This action closes a chapter in the American experience.
When I saw the last helicopter left the top of the U.S. Embassy, I felt I was not really angry, but hurt. Like, you know, you trust you are a really good friend. You think that you have been having a good friend. You work together for so long. And when you are in danger or in hardship, they even, you know, instead of helping you, they turn their back away.
We pulled out, meaning Special Operations Unit, close to 2,000 people. We couldn't pull out anymore because it was beyond human endurance to go anymore. I'm back now. I got back today. I am in bits and pieces, fairly incoherent only because it's been such a fast pace. I have no word on when I will be withdrawn. I haven't had a chance to feel it out, really. I'll just have to wait and see.
But Air Force Second Lieutenant Richard Vandegeer had one more helicopter rescue after he made this tape. When the Cambodians seized the SS Mayaguez in May of 1975, Van de Geer was again called into action. He was airlifting a squadron of Marines when a rocket hit his helicopter. At the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, where the names of the dead are listed chronologically, Richard Van de Geer's name is last.
Again, Dick, I apologize for the very poor way that I have explained to you what has been happening. I don't think it will be too terribly long before we are together again. I wish you peace. And I have a great deal of faith that the future has to be ours. Adios, my friend.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our love.
You've been listening to The Fall of Saigon, produced by Art Silverman. Originally broadcast on NPR's All Things Considered in 1985 for the 10th anniversary of the end of the war, April 30th, 1975, known by some Vietnamese as Reunification Day and others as Black April. Thanks to Maureen Clements, NPR librarian. I'm Scott Carrier, and our website is hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.